Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, this is the podcast of Julianne Moore.
For you.
Because Julianne Moore's in not only two movies this week, but in those two movies, she plays two roles, so there are four Julianne Moore roles this week.
And how many of those four did I see?
Zero.
Exactly. So it's all you, babe.
All right. We'll start off with the wine. And I'm going to go ahead and admit, it's a stretch.
Another stretch.
So what are you looking at here?
I'm looking at Gnarly Head 1924 Limited Edition, a double black red wine blend.
So the 1924 is from, they started this vineyard during Prohibition.
Okay.
But that has nothing to do with it. 1924. The only reason I picked this wine is because half of Wonderstruck is set in 1927.
That's beyond a stretch. Yeah. It doesn't even count as a stretch. That's called, I just wanted to get a bottle of wine. I saw this one. The label was kind of cool. And it's actually quite tasty.
It actually is very good.
Yeah.
We took a week off last week. We are back after a week hiatus because where did we go?
We went to the fifth Middleburg Film Festival.
The fifth
one. It's hit the big time now out in lovely Middleburg, Virginia.
What a fascinating little town.
It's a great little town of very wealthy folk.
Very wealthy folk.
And horses.
We do not go there and get a hotel.
No, it's called staying on the outskirts of town for a much cheaper price. But it's still, it's a fun festival to go to. It's a chance to just get an early read on some of the potential Oscar nominees.
And I bet we saw some.
I think we did see some. And Hobnob, with a few of our fellow colleagues.
We'll talk about it later, but you got to interview someone one-on-one.
I did. I got about 5 minutes with Greta Gerwig.
Ooh la la.
One of your favorite, most quirky actresses out there.
Frances Ha.
And she actually directed she wrote and directed a new movie that'll be out soon, and we'll talk about it in a future podcast called Lady Bird.
All right, well, we did not see this weekend's biggest release, widest release, and the one that will win the box office, because the studio did not choose to show critics Jigsaw, which is technically Saw 7. They did not show us Jigsaw. That's code for...
It's code for it's going to do really well without showing it to the critics. So why mess up a good thing? And very much like we all missed Boo, the Tyler Perry movie that came out while we were at Middleburg. Boo 2. And Boo 2 also did quite well and probably was really stupid. And it doesn't matter.
Well, that'll come in probably second this week. Mm-hmm. Jigsaw will come in first because it's not because it's Halloween. It's because Americans just love to go see horror films.
Yeah, and I'm not particularly fond of horror films. I liked It, but beyond that, none of those Saw movies ever really appealed to me.
The second biggest release this week is Suburbicon. And we are going to talk about Suburbicon, or at least I will talk about Suburbicon because you didn't see it.
And I wanted to.
Tell me your reason why you didn't go see it.
Why didn't I go see it? So Suburbicon, I wanted to see it because George Clooney directs it. And so that would have been the main reason. But I think it was up against the movie that I saw, Thank You for Your Service.
No. Suburbicon was Monday. You went to Thank You for Your Service on Tuesday. I thought you didn't go just because you saw the preview and you thought it looked stupid.
No, there was something else on Monday. There was a reason.
You think of your excuse and let me know by the end of the podcast.
Okay.
George Clooney, he broke into directing with...
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I must interrupt.
You're right.
I was tired.
There it is.
And I saw the trailer and it looked like even though my heart was with George for this one, I had a feeling I was not going to like it. I just did not like the premise in the trailer, and so I was exhausted. I had seen 12 movies in the previous 5 days, and therefore I decided to skip it. So, hit me up. How was it?
Well, spoiler alert, just about nobody liked it.
I know.
Including me. I hated this movie. George Clooney, broken in directing with Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I don't know if you remember that from back
in the day.
His best movie to date as a director was probably Good Night and Good Luck.
Great movie.
Love that movie. His most recent one was 2014's The Monuments Men.
Which is okay, but it didn't suck. It just wasn't very good.
So he's been known to show up in Coen Brothers films. Mm-hmm. You know, most he was in Hail Caesar.
Oh, brother, where art thou?
Burn After Reading. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he calls him a repertoire player, a company man.
Sure.
So this is an old Coen Brothers script from back in like 99. They were going to make this movie. It fell through. Never got made. They cast him in a role. And he was writing a script with Grant Heslov, and they were researching racial incidents that happened in Levittown, Pennsylvania, back in 57. An African-American family moves into this lily-white suburb, because remember, after World War II, white flight, all the white families moved to the suburbs, GI Bill, the whole thing. And, lo and behold, an African-American family moves in, and there's a petition goes around, they want them out. They start singing songs 24/7, all night, banging pots and pans. Like, they want this family out. So he's writing a script about this, and he remembers this old Coen Brothers script about a typical Coen Brothers plot where people make bad decisions. Think Fargo. Mm-hmm. Think Raising Arizona. And he put them together, and lo and behold, we have Suburbicon. Oh, man, I don't even know where to start.
Well, it's never a good idea to try and suddenly thread two different ideas together when there was probably a definite tone and theme to the Coen Brothers movie that probably just did not translate into this added little race relations tidbit.
Well, he purposefully made it darker. Coen Brothers are lighter, you know, they're cheeky, they're funny, but not funny ha-ha, but funny like irony.
Mm-hmm.
The irony's here, but it's while the entire neighborhood is threatening and oppressing and scaring this African-American family, mom, dad, and kid. Just next door, Matt Damon's family is a freak show, a horror movie. And the irony is, look next door at your own kind. You're focusing on the wrong people in the neighborhood. Two evil men, break into Matt Damon's house. They tie up the family, chloroform the whole thing. Not a spoiler, Julianne Moore, mom dies. Just dies. So the rest of the film, you think, is, okay, how are you going to put your lives back together? The kid, he's very good. 9-year-old, 10-year-old, Noah Jupe is his name. He's very good. He'll be on my youth performances list. Matt Damon as the dad is heartbroken. His sister-in-law, Julianne Moore's sister, played by Julianne Moore, moves in because Nikki, requires a mother figure. And things just start to go sideways. Stories start to change. Things aren't adding up. That's the Coen Brothers stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Bad decisions are made. Oscar Isaac, Isaac shows up. The best part of the film starts to steal it. Like, finally, the redeeming factor about Suburbicon. And it just all goes to crap. It reminded me of the Coen Brothers remake of The Lady Killers. I don't know if you remember that with Tom Hanks.
No.
It's such a sour taste. There's no catharsis. It's so evil. It's so mean. The carnage. It's hard to watch.
Well, and that's the vibe that I got from the little snippet that I saw, was that it was a movie that was hard to watch and was not going to be at all enjoyable on any level. And so even though I generally always like a Matt Damon film and a George Clooney film, there was just something I just kind of knew. I had one of those gut check reactions that was, I'll just let Charlie handle this one. And if somebody else tells me that it's really good, I'll potentially give it a shot. But if my instincts are correct, I'll feel glad that I took the night off.
Well, I think it's 28% on the tomato meter. But it looks like the 50s, so they got their production design down, they got the vintage Oldsmobile out, the boxy hedgerows out front, they repainted houses, looks totally like the 50s. Now, Matt Damon, no one who looks like Matt Damon existed in the 1950s. Jason Bourne did not exist in the 50s, so he put on a few pounds here. He's a heavier Matt Damon, but it's still, I don't know, that's Matt Damon.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure about that.
All right.
So It's very, half of it's this racist mob going, you know, nothing bad happened before they arrived. And Clooney even said it was a lighter movie, but I was editing it during the election when Trump was elected.
So he was depressed.
And he noticed, he said, America got angrier. So I deliberately made an angrier film. and I recut it to make it darker and angrier, and I believe him. He totally did. He cut out Josh Brolin, who was in the movie, and he didn't help himself. Congratulations, you're trying to match America's mood, but maybe we go to the movies now to feel lighter,
exactly,
to get
you
away from it.
You want to escape
he
that
gave
mood.
Us, he gave us what we see every day, an angrier America.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Yeah, and the movie is no fun, except for Oscar Isaac, who's okay. Okay, let's move on from Suburbicon and never talk about it again.
Okay.
You saw a movie then on Tuesday that I did not see called...
Thank you for your service.
So that I'm just going to, I haven't seen the previews, but I'm going to guess it's about the military.
You haven't seen the previews at all?
No.
All right. And I actually think you would have liked this one. It's about these, a few soldiers returning to the Midwest. They're returning from war, from Iraq in 2007. And it's about their reintegrating back into society and family life. And they've obviously got elements of PTSD. And it's based on a true story and a book that was and it's got Miles Teller playing this Sergeant Adam Schumann.
Mr. Whiplash,
Divergent, War Dogs, and in another movie this same week called Only the Brave that's still out. So I like Miles Teller a lot. He's really good in this film. He plays an Army sergeant who, you know, led like 10 or 12 men in his unit in Iraq, and he was really well respected. And there were a couple of incidents that happened while he was there that just haunt him when he returns home. And a similar thing is happening with one of his war buddies, played by this guy. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. He's American Samoan, Beulah Kowali, perhaps. He's on Hawaii Five-O now, which I knew I'd recognized him from somewhere. But he plays this officer named, this soldier named Solo, and his role is really powerful, and he had a traumatic brain injury of some sort. And so he still is also trying to recover, and his wife is pregnant, and he's trying to kind of get his life back on track, but he's shell-shocked and he's numb, and he really actually wants to get back to his unit, and he's still just so passionate about the military, but he can't. I mean, he definitely has some sort of brain injury. He's forgetful all the time, and so he and Sergeant Schumann both go to the VA together to try and get benefits and get some psychiatric help. And one of the most frustrating parts of this movie for the viewer is here these guys are really trying hard. They recognize that they need help. They go to seek it out. And there's this like insane backlog. It makes the DMV seem like a joyride. And so it really is a tribute to returning troops and to sort of tell the story of those that are really trying, that still face all these battles when they get home. And so it's not one of those movies that's like, oh my gosh, this was a great movie, but it's definitely solid. It's a solid movie. And, I think it's a good time if you're going to see it with Veterans Day coming down the pike. It's a good choice to see.
Did you see, I did not see it earlier this year. Did you see Megan Levy?
Yes.
So is it kind of...
It's more raw and authentic than Megan Levy was. Megan Levy was really about this woman and her dog.
And something we saw at Middleburg. What about Last Flag Flying? So there appears to be a thing coming around.
There is
around
a thing coming around. And I was going to say that anyone who, if this material just seems a little too heavy for anyone for Veterans Day, you have Last Flag Flying coming down the pike, which is a much lighter...
Wait a minute. The movie about
more
the
comedy.
Dead soldier.
I know. Well, no, because this one, I mean, you got to realize the trauma that... this is a very quiet movie, the Thank You for Your Service, except for when they're flashing back to a couple of incidents. I mean, one of the opening scenes is really gory. Somebody gets shot in the head. And Miles Teller's character is carrying him down some stairs, and the blood is everywhere, and he drops him. And that's really that kind of permeates throughout the movie, was the guilt that he's feeling about having dropped his buddy because he was bleeding so much, and the sergeant was choking on the buddy's blood. And then there's an incident that followed soon after that that also leads him to just have this sort of survivor's guilt hanging over his head. Amy Schumer pops up in this movie.
What?
As the widow of one of...
She went dramatic?
Of one of his commanding officers. And it's a small role, and it's very dramatic.
Have we ever seen Amy Schumer in a drama?
I don't know, but you would never know. It took me a minute. I was like, oh, wait a second. That's Amy Schumer.
She trying to branch out a little bit?
I guess so. And she's very good in it. And you would really never, ever... think that that was the kind of role she would take on. It's a small one, but she's good in it. So that's, you know, that was definitely an interesting twist. And then the wives, for the most part, don't have much to do in this film. It's really about primarily these two guys getting back and just doing what they have to do to try and survive and get past their trauma and just some of the hardships they face. And just a reminder that... you know, that it's a big part of what's going on with so many troops returning and the difference between, you know, you get used to seeing so many people returning without limbs. And at one point, one of the characters actually feels almost jealous of the soldiers that have these visible external injuries because people are more sympathetic towards them. And here somebody whose injuries and wounds are really internal are not as easily treated.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a good movie. Miles Teller, I mean, he's playing sort of, it's funny, first responder types. He's a very strong but vulnerable type of character in Thank You for Your Service. And last week I saw him in Only the Brave, where he played one of the firefighters who were killed in a wildfire in Arizona back in, I think it was 2013. And so in that one, and that's another true story. So here within the span of 2 weeks, he's in two movies playing somewhat similar.
He wishes he could be Julianne Moore. Two, yes. Two characters in 2 weeks is something, but four characters in 1 week, come on.
But both are actually, what's interesting is I suspect both will do about the same at the box office. So while Only the Brave was also a very good movie based on a true story that is kind of about modern day heroes, Thank You for Your Service is similar. Only the Brave did not seem to catch on all that much at the box office. So I suspect, however, that ended up at the box office.
I don't think Thank You for Your Service will either.
I think this one's going to be on par with that one in terms of who goes to see it.
Yeah, just a hunch.
It's the same audience would like it.
It's coming out the same weekend as everyone's going to go see that horror movie.
Which is a shame.
I think Suburbicon might even do better.
I think it will. But these are two, both Only the Brave and Thank You for Your Service are two of those movies that will be a decent watch on Netflix at some point, or catch it on, stream it from somewhere down the road.
Very good. All right. Well, now for something completely different. Wonderstruck. I caught this at Middleburg, and it is opening, I think, limited this weekend, more nationwide as the week's progress. When I say Todd Haynes, maybe you think Far From Heaven. Maybe you think Carol. Remember Carol from just a year or two
ago?
I love Carol. Kate Blanchett, I think, won an Oscar for it. Rooney Mara, the love that dare not speak its name in the 50s. Todd Haynes.
She didn't win for that, did she?
I thought Kate Blanchett won.
I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
So Todd Haynes does these period pieces, these era-specific taboo sexual relationship films. Like Far From Heaven and Carol were very similar in that film. Far From Heaven was Julianne Moore and Dennis Haysbert, interracial love in the 50s because her husband Dennis Quaid was closeted gay. In Carol, it was two ladies discovering themselves. Well, Wonderstruck is a kid's movie. Todd Haynes directed a kid's film. So, and it's based off a best-selling book. Brian Selznick, he wrote a book called The Invention of Hugo Cabret, which was turned into a film by Martin Scorsese called Hugo. Remember Hugo?
Yes.
Loved Hugo. I think that was on my top 10 list that year. Well, he then wrote another book in 2011 called Wonderstruck. Wonderstruck is a parallel movie. It's told in parallel. You got Story number one set in 77. Kid loses his mother. He's, I don't know, 12, 13. Oakes Fegley, we remember him from Pete's Dragon. He was the new kid from Pete's Dragon. Mm-hmm. He loses his mother. He doesn't know who his dad is. He finds a clue, so he runs away from middle of nowhere, Minnesota, to the scary New York City. And remember, New York City back in 77 was dirty and crime-ridden. It wasn't, you know, necessarily New York City of today. 50 years before that, 1927, and this is how they edit it together. So we got 2 minutes of him, and then we get 2 minutes of the girl in 1927, 50 years ago. It's shot in black and white, and it's completely silent. Hmm. Just like movies were in 1927. They were silent films. We watch her run away from her home to New York City. They're mirroring each other. They both run away to the city, and they both wind up in the Museum of Natural History. They see the same things, they have similar experiences, and they're both deaf.
Wow. Boy, a lot going on in this film.
So the girl that was deaf from birth, the boy from Minnesota in 77 just turned deaf after a lightning accident. Stay with me. Mm-hmm. So this movie actually should be called Coincidences, not Wonderstruck.
Was it like struck by lightning? Was that the wonder?
He was on the phone in a lightning storm, and the lightning went through the cord. I don't know if that's a thing. But it got him.
Okay.
And so they both wind up in the Museum of Natural History, and there's a mystery, like, okay, who is his dad? How does this girl connect to the boy 50 years later? And there's a connection. And so I want to talk about the girl is played by Millicent Simmons. She's brand new, never really, you know, seen her before. She's so good. She is so good, and she's deaf in real life. Mm. And it's an homage to silent movies. I did not know this. In silent movies, they frequently hired deaf actors. Because they're so good at expressing themselves. You needed facial expressions in silent film to really get across what you're doing, get across your feelings. Deaf actors were just better at that. But in 27, it was also the first talking film. They transitioned to talkies, no more deaf actors. So I love that Todd Haynes did that. Hired there were about 7 or 8 deaf actors in this film. And, yep, Julianne Moore pops up again. Twice! I think I'm with the majority on this. It just didn't connect. It doesn't, you know, the story's intriguing. I was like, okay, that's cool. I like this back and forth, black and white, 77, 27 whole thing. It didn't connect. It didn't land. There's no weight. I wasn't feeling it. Ugh, I don't understand where the lack of feeling is.
I'm guessing that because there is still awards buzz around it, like I heard about it and I thought about trying to catch it at Middleburg, I just couldn't fit it in. I could not fit it into the schedule. And so I figure a screener will show up at some point. But I was surprised at how few people seem to embrace this movie. I don't know if it's one of those either you love it or you don't kind of films, but I'll be surprised to see if when all the other awards movies really start coming out, whether this one is still in that tier. What exactly are people raving about that it would be awards
movie? I really haven't heard any raves, and I haven't heard anybody say this is an awards movie. Now, people hated Suburbicon. Nobody hated this movie.
Right.
Well, I think a couple people, there was applause. There's always applause at film festivals. And people liked it. Some people really did like it. But no one said this is going to win. It's not, trust me, it won't be nominated for anything.
Okay.
And I just think Todd Haynes is such an odd person to choose to film this movie. He's proven he can shoot in period specific films. So maybe they chose him because they knew he could pull off 1927 in 1977. But he shoots sexual identity films and taboo relationship films. Like, what is he doing in a kid's movie? Is that why it didn't work? I don't know. Is it just that the story is hanging on by a thread because of the amount of coincidences? Good Lord. I heard the book is like half graphic novel, especially the one set in 27. I don't think it had any words in it. You just had to kind of figure it out for yourself. Hmm. Is that why it didn't connect? There's something missing here, Hannah.
Julianne Moore alone was not enough to do it for you?
No, and the end is all exposition. It's like, okay, let me fill in the entire mystery and explanation for you in this 12-minute soliloquy.
That's never good.
You didn't earn it. You didn't fight for it.
Well, we just saw Julianne in, what was it, the Kingsman sequel.
She wasn't. She was the villain.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, she's just had
she's everywhere.
A rocking year.
Lord.
She and Miles Teller now have to do a movie together. Although, were they both in a Divergent movie?
Wait a minute.
Wow.
Who was Julianne Moore in Divergent?
Wasn't she in one of them?
I don't know if she was in... She was in The Hunger Games.
Is that... Am I getting all my YA...
And that's easy, because they're all dystopian future...
That's right.
Kind of schlock.
Well, I still think... I suspect maybe I would like Wonderstruck a little better than you.
Absolutely. But I'm not saying I hate it.
Yeah.
But I do not think you would love this movie.
Okay, good. Well, we'll find out.
I don't think you would
eventually be
railing at me going, how did you not love this movie?
But certainly that's one that, unlike Suburbicon, where I kind of am writing that one off right away because nobody I know has liked it. Wonderstruck has struck a little more of a middle of the road chord.
You know who also says it lacks feeling and weight? Christian Hammacher.
Gotta get Christian's shout out in the podcast.
He wasn't feeling this movie either.
Okay.
So
I definitely have to watch it.
I'm on better ground on that one.
All right.
Our fourth film is one of those flash in the pan. Yes, it's in French. It's a documentary.
Easy to watch.
Had to throw it in there. The Paris Opera. It's a documentary set in the 2015-2016 Paris Opera season. So we watch them preparing, practicing for operas and ballets, all the way from the president of the theater, all the way down to the chorus line. And, oh my God, blech.
Yeah, I mean, it the first half hour, I was like, oh my gosh, this is really weak. And they set it up with title cards that you basically know that that the Paris Opera has two venues. And I mean, they're historic. The venues themselves
are
gorgeous.
We just saw the Paris Opera in Leap.
Yes. And so the Palais Garnier was built in 1875, and that's the one that we're used to seeing.
Is that the one we saw?
Yeah, and it's gorgeous. And then I guess they built this Opera Bastille in 1989 as a second venue. But it's all about, they frame it around, it's the inaugural season of this new director of the opera. So this guy, Stefan Lisner. And this is one of what happened was, though, at about halfway through, about 50 minutes into this movie, it got interesting for a while, like for about a half hour.
Remind me what happened.
I really like when you're seeing the actual ballet rehearsals and on stage. When you're seeing actual opera singers in rehearsal and then on stage, there's a moment that I really loved. I mean, part of what they were trying to do was get across all the politics. I mean, it really was about this guy's first season at the helm and all that he's going through, trying to take it all in a new creative direction, make it more accessible to the masses, all of that sort of thing. But there's a national strike that goes on in the middle of the season.
Yeah, I didn't know, ballet dancers and opera singers, and especially the chorus line, could so freely strike and cancel your performances.
Well, I guess there's what they were trying to get across is, I guess they really rely on funding from the government.
Yeah.
And that was constantly being threatened. And
Natalie Portman's husband is a player until he quits. He was the choreographer, Benjamin.
Oh.
It looks like Millipede, but it's not
husband.
Benjamin,
oh,
whatever.
Okay.
That's Natalie Portman's husband.
Oh my gosh, I didn't make that connection. That's kind of cool. But, you know, there's the Bataclan massacre that had happened in the nightclub.
Briefly touched on.
I think they kind of shoehorn that in a little bit. They shoehorn in a few too many things that aren't interesting. But there is, did you remember the scenes, though? There was the young, impressionable...
The Russian singer, the kid,
and he's got this moment where he's just in awe of this Welsh singer.
Oh, he meets like the opera version of Clooney.
Yeah, exactly. This guy, I don't know, Bryn Terfel, so I don't know if anyone's an opera fan who knows this guy. But he certainly acknowledges right away, he sees that this kid is just following him around. He's pretty much obsessed. It was a little borderline obsessive, but it was so sweet. There's a moment where the singer tells somebody who's interviewing him, who thinks that the Russian kid is just some admirer, he says, oh, he's not an admirer, he's a singer just like I am, we're in the same boat. And you just see the joy, the sheer joy and adoration in the Russian kid's eyes. And it was sweet. It was a sweet moment. And so you had, I would say, 20 minutes to a half hour in the middle of this film that were very endearing and were very interesting to watch. And then it just sort of never closes the loop on things, never quite connects the dot of a narrative.
There might not be a narrative because it's a different sort of documentary. I'm going to lob a word. It's cinema verite, which is a very fancy way of saying the camera just sits and observes and stares. There's no commentary. Like, they're not talking to you in voiceover. Right. They're not even interviewing any talking heads one-on-one. They're not lobbing a question and someone's answering it. So they're just sitting back and they're hoping something happens and they catch it on camera. That is called cinema verite.
Well, and it could and should have been much tighter. This probably would have been, we mentioned earlier, a really good, solid 80-minute film. There was no reason that it should have gone on for an hour and 50 minutes.
I was ready for this thing to end.
This is the kind of documentary that I do think, though, that opera buffs and ballet fans will actually find some appreciation in seeing all the behind-the-scenes stuff and the nod to the below-the-line people to see what exactly all that goes into to staging a season of the ballet and the opera. But it could easily play on, to me, it's something like if you were watching, stumbled across the Ovation Channel or the PBS Pledge Drive.
The hell's the Ovation Channel?
It's like an arts, it's an arts channel that basically just will, at least it used to just play like scenes from an opera or, it's art stuff. It's like MTV for the arts.
Oh.
And so this is the kind of thing that would fit there. But I also totally could see it being interrupted every 10 minutes by the PBS Pledge Drive as some, you know, bringing you this behind the scenes footage from the Paris Opera.
Well, I got my wife to watch it because I told her, remember how much you liked Ballet 422, which was about, you know, how the sausage making behind whatever ballet it was in New York City, I think it was. And she's like, oh, yeah, I did like Ballet 422. She did not care for the she quit 20 minutes before the end. She just couldn't handle
it
anymore.
And that's the problem is it just couldn't put it all together in a good enough package to maintain people's interest. It has snippets that are valuable. I just wish somebody would go back and re-edit it, give it some voiceover, and turn it into like a one-hour special on
PBS.
I think
my favorite part fell into that half hour you're talking about. They kept making the opera guy say, Wurst.
Yes. Wurst.
And it's like, Wurst. I'm saying it. No, you're not saying it. It's like,
and then
I'm
was
laughing.
He the same opera guy who then called it one? And then the other guy that he's supposed to be singing with calls in sick at the last
was
minute.
Was that the guy?
I think it was the guy he must have been. No, it was like there was this heavier set guy who was.
I couldn't tell who it was.
I know, but then the Yeah, but then the Wurst guy was still there because he was just meeting his
that was awesome.
The guy he was supposed to be singing with on stage.
So yeah,
that
there's
night.
Some final drama at the end.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's
got moments.
This did not hold my interest. There's nothing going on here.
There's some. I think if you know who these people are, if you know these opera singers, and some of what they're staging, I think Moses and Aaron was their opening.
Man, they're talking about an opera.
Number.
I would not want to sit through. That looks terrible.
So I don't know, but so that's sort of the first one that they're staging, and I think that that if you have season tickets to the opera and the ballet, maybe you'll get more out of this than we did.
Well, they probably understand it more.
Yes.
All right, you wanted to talk about the film festival a little bit and combine it with catching up with some films we saw last week but we didn't cover because we took the week off.
That's right, because you saw, well, Faces Places was just one I did not want to let completely slide, and I was reminded about it because of the Paris Opera, and I'm like, here's a better French film if you're going to go see
I'm shocked. Hannah's like, there's a better French
if
film
if you're
than
going
the
to go
film.
See a French documentary.
You hate French documentaries.
Faces Places I really liked, and Artie Chick loved it. I loved it. You loved it.
I did.
That means it's probably a pretty darn good documentary.
It's a great documentary.
And so tell us what it's about, Charlie.
It's a duo, but it's an unlikely duo. It's Agnes Varda, who's 88 in the film. She's a bit over now, but she's one of the French New Wave. We're talking Jean-Luc Godard, François Truffaut. She's one of the French New Wave from the late 50s, early 60s, who made a different sort of cinema than had ever existed. And Letters from Cleo, I think, is her really claim to fame. She's 88 now, and she has made a documentary with J.R. J.R. But they call, she calls him J.R. He's 33, and he's an artist slash muralist. And they drive around the French countryside, no cities. They take pictures. They look at a place and like, you know what? What could we do to this? And the things they think up are so original, so creative. I loved seeing what they turned out. My favorite one. Well, I have two favorites. They go to the salt factory, and they take a picture of the day shift, and they take a picture of the night shift holding out their hands, and they put it on the wall, and they're reaching out and almost touching each other, like the roof of the Sistine Chapel with like a finger up, but they don't quite. And it's like, oh, that's really a good idea. And then they go to this mining town, which no one lives there anymore, although because they don't mine there anymore, and there's only one woman left on this whole row of townhouses. And they plaster the houses with pictures of the old miners, and it's really affecting, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's 88 minutes, so hooray!
And no wonder I liked it.
They just drive around in a camera truck.
Yes,
the truck looks
I love
like a camera, and it spits out like this Polaroid picture on the side of the truck.
A giant.
And they
Polaroid
just
picture.
And you can it's a lot of it's posed. They have these staged conversations about what are we going to do here, Agnes? Well, I do not know, J.R. But it works. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it was a little contrived at the beginning, and I was like, I thought this was a documentary, but this seems awfully scripted. And then once they hit the road, and it's a road trip movie, and they're just basically cruising the countryside and going through all these villages in France, looking for inspiration in the people and the places. And the French title of this is Visages, villages. Faces, places. And it just brings you in. And I equate it to an extended version of one of those CBS Sunday morning types of segments.
Oh, yeah, I like that analogy.
Yeah,
that's
where
cool.
It's like, you know, they go across America and they come across these people. Everyone has a story kind of idea. And that to me is what this felt like. And so I think it's what makes this film great is that I think it can appeal to so many different people on different levels. I was not familiar at all. I enjoyed it separate from even knowing anything about new wave cinema in France or any of that. So I don't think you have to...
You do not know. You do not have to know who Agnes Varda is. A lot of cinephiles will know. French people will know. But you do not need to know who. You just know she's old and she's done things, and she's with this guy 55 years younger than she is, and they're a perfect match. Like they fit together.
And dare I say, it's actually quite sweet, Charlie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to use the word sweet.
Charming.
But
it's charming.
At the end, they try to meet Jean-Luc Godard. He's still alive, and he's still, you know, he's made films recently in the past couple years, but he's very old now, and he does something not very nice. Mm-hmm. We never actually see him, but at the end, J.R. does something for Agnes that she's been wanting him to do, and it fits, and it works, and it ties it up in a neat little bow, and so that does make it sweet. But, you know it's good because Hannah likes it, and it's because it's a French documentary. Hannah hates French documentaries.
Not all of them.
There's a thing with goats in it, which is awesome.
Yeah, no, it just had so many moments. Even if you didn't like one particular snippet, there was something right around the corner.
It moves.
It moves, and that's why I liked it.
Like, I didn't care about that dock worker thing with it, but the women in the containers, you remember that? And it's like,
yeah.
That's like the ultimate one. That's like their climax, and it's like, it didn't really... hit me. But.
Yeah, but it was all towards a greater purpose and so much better than that B-side thing about the photographer who had the giant Polaroids.
Oh, it's way better than the B-side.
It's so much better, and yet, you know, here was somebody who was kind of doing that same general thing with just...
That was an Errol Morris film, for crying out loud.
So Faces, Places, if you just want a sweet, charming, feel-good documentary, that would be the one that I would direct it to.
I mean, it's probably already gone from theaters, so this is the one you find on Netflix that one night when there's nothing to watch. And it's not long, and it's just fun. You can talk about it, and you want to dissect it a little bit.
And you kind of want to go and find that little camera truck and have your picture taken and see what what you can do with it. But just fascinating.
Another one that I caught at the film festival that was also released last week was Breathe. I don't really want to talk about it, but it's the theory of everything. Remember Stephen Hawking? Eddie Redmayne won an Oscar for that. It's the lesser cousin of that.
I liked it.
It's the guy with polio, and he's like, oh, he's so got endurance and he does crazy things with
it's
life.
It's Andrew
with
Garfield. I love Andrew Garfield.
But I want to talk about the director.
I really liked it.
Andy Serkis. It's his first feature film. Andy Serkis is Gollum from The Lord of the Rings. He's Caesar the Ape from the most recent Planet of the Apes trilogy. So he's this performance artist, a stop motion capture guy that everyone says he should win an Oscar someday. You know, he's just as much as an actor as anyone else. Well, he directed a film, and it's The Theory of Everything, but not good.
Oh, I disagree. I actually liked it. I liked it. It's a theory of every. It's a mishmash. It's more chick flicky, so it's definitely in the chick flick genre. So I can see why you would poo poo it, but
it proves to me if I ever get sick, I hope I have a British wife because they're so plucky.
it's a love story. It's very much a love story about this guy who gets, and based on a true story as well, mm-hmm. about this guy who gets polio in the 1950s and how his wife just basically gives him hope and reason to live, and he's got really good friends and family surrounding him. And
Tom Hollander pulls a Julianne Moore. He plays two characters. He plays twins.
The brothers, yeah. So it's, I do think that if you, this is the kind of movie that if I had to equate it, it was a little bit of the Me Before You vibe too.
Yeah, but Me Before You was moved and had.
No. This
had
is,
that
no.
good looking girl in
See,
it.
This
no,
is,
it had Amelia Clark in it.
Had
I mean,
Amelia
come on.
Clark.
Yeah.
But this is, if you liked Me Before You.
This is Claire Foy, so if you like The Crown.
I think if you liked Me Before You and Theory of Everything.
No, I liked Me Before You and Theory of Everything.
No, but I'm saying
and I
it's a combination.
Like this. I did not like this movie.
Well, I just think you're, I think you're overly critical of it. I think there's plenty of people that will enjoy this for just being a, and Andrew Garfield is really good. And I just think it's one of those, catch it on Netflix, catch it on an airplane.
Andrew Garfield was better as Desmond Doss in
absolutely.
Hacksaw Ridge.
Well, I mean, he's paralyzed in this one.
Yeah, which actually should make for a stronger performance because he's really got to express himself.
And I do. Andrew Garfield's always good. Like, I have not seen him not deliver a good performance in anything
that
in
first
recent
Spider-Man
years.
Was a little.
I even like the first Spider-Man. I don't think we needed him as Spider-Man, but I liked him as Spider-Man. And
he was great in, you ever see Silence? He was great in Silence.
He's great in everything in the past few years. So I don't think anybody could actually point to anything and say that it's that he's ever not given a good performance. And everybody delivers very good performances in Breathe. Is it Oscar caliber?
No. I'm close.
But is it better than a lot of the stuff that we've seen in recent months?
No.
Absolutely.
No, it's right on. It's average to slightly below. It's right at average.
It's average to slightly above average.
Not even close. It's probably the worst one we've talked about on this except Suburbicon.
No, I totally disagree.
All right. Is there anything you else wanted to talk about Middleburg?
No, I think we'll. I think we can hold our.
Well, next week I think we're hitting two Middleburg films or one.
Yeah,
they're going to keep popping up.
And maybe we'll do a Middleburg overview with a little more atmospherics and all. Because I saw 12 movies in Middleburg.
Good grief.
So I could go through them all for you. So as we maybe for a Thanksgiving week special, we'll do a Middleburg recap.
Well, there is a Middleburg. Yeah, we are going to talk about one next week. The Square. Which I actually haven't seen yet, but it was there.
Uh-huh.
All right. Yeah, anything else you want to talk about there?
No, I think that'll do it for this week.
Quick recap, Suburbicon.
Glad I missed it.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you for your service. It's solid.
Wonderstruck. Wrong director. Something's missing.
I think I need to see it now because I'm not trusting your judgment this evening.
don't doubt Christian. Christian's going to come after you.
I can doubt Christian too.
The Paris Opera.
I think there were elements to it that will definitely appeal to some of the arty crowd.
We touched on Faces Places. Hooray!
Best film, I think, of the ones I saw just in terms of sheer enjoyment.
Yeah, it's the best film we talked about this evening.
Yes.
At least. Breathe.
Yeah. I like Breathe.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to kind of a hodgepodge catch-up Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt. Pete.com.